Hi, I'm Dimitri Kleiner, as Johannes mentioned, and I've got this little slideshow, which I'll be constantly distracted with, but I'll do my best to get through it quickly, and then hopefully we can have more of a conversation. I'm the Telekommunisten Collective. We're based in Berlin, and we work on various projects to do with the political economy of networks, including providing services and doing artworks and doing texts. The language that I use is the language of classical political economy. And so I'm going to explain some of my terms up front just to kind of make sure. Just simple terms, most of you probably already know them, but it's amazing how many times a lot of misunderstanding can happen. By networks, I mean computer networks, not social networks or weaves or anything else, especially those connected to the internet. And just like technology jargon, political terms have a specialized meaning, which can be confusing. So let's be a little bit clear. Communism doesn't refer, at least when I use it, to any form of historical government or contemporary communist states, right? Communism is a theoretical society with no classes and no state, right? So communism is an idea, and it's an idea that's been around for a long time, much, much, much longer than the Cold War, much longer than even the works of Karl Marx. It originates among the British and French cooperative movements, especially people like the followers of Robert Owen, who was a cooperative innovator in the States. And what communism essentially means is a society in which the workers themselves own the means of production, but particularly in a form that has no classes and no state. Socialism is often distinguished as a society where they own it publicly, but even these terms are used differently in different historical eras. You can't hear me? Is that better? Oh, come on. Small room. Anyway, so communism is a model of a society. So we're not talking about any particular state or history. And capitalism does not refer to the free market, enterprise, business, entrepreneurship, or liberal democracy. Right? Capitalism is also a technical term, and capitalism refers to a society in which the owners of capital are able to abstain from direct production. I mean, you can read that yourself, by appropriating the products of workers who employ their property in production. I don't know if that's clear enough, but what that essentially means is capitalism is a system where a certain class of owners, called capitalists, owns the means of production, and they employ a class of workers, called the proletariat, which apply their labor to the property of these owners, and therefore create products, and the products are appropriated by the owners. This is what's called capitalism. It doesn't necessarily imply any of the things that are referred to as capitalism, like entrepreneurship and liberal democracy and all these things that we associate with capitalism in sort of our common everyday language. Capitalism is specifically a structure, a mode of production. Right? You know you're in a capitalist mode of production when the person that made the goods doesn't actually own them in the end, but the owners of the people who provided the means of production, the machines, the land, and so forth, own them. Right? And the term originates among the Ricardian socialists, early critiques of political economy, and was the whole purpose of the term capitalism was to draw a correlation with feudalism, right? So capitalism wasn't invented as a positive term by Forbes magazine, the way they use it in their advertising. Capitalism was actually invented by the critics of capitalism. So it wasn't the capitalists that were talking about capitalism. Capitalism was invented as a critical term, and here's an example of its early usage from Thomas Hodgkins in 1825. From his famous essay and presentation to Parliament called Labor Defended Against the Claims of Capital, and in which he sort of lays out this argument. Note this is 1825, so this is far before the Communist Manifesto of 1848, right? And doesn't start there. William Thomas before him also made similar criticisms, and the term is invented to be something that is a critical term. It's not meant to be a positive term, although it has been, through propaganda, turned into something of a positive term and associated with freedom and all this kind of stuff. But that's not what it means, not in political discourse. All right? And so modes of production, just like networks, are kinds of relationships, right? So it's about relationships and interconnections, right? And both economies and networks are composed of these relationships, right? That's what makes a mode of production. That's what makes a network, is the way that the participants in that network or that economy are related to each other, right? So the relations define the topology in a network, and relations in an economy define the mode of production, right? So the difference between capitalism and communism is based on the relationships among the producers and among the social classes. Relationships in our network are the relationship between the nodes in the network, the various parts that share the network and communicate over it, right? So on one hand, it's a topology, and on the other hand, it's a mode of production, but they're both structures, and they're both structures that describe how things are related, right? In mesh networks, such as for instance, the internet or anything in where many nodes can interact, all the participants can interact directly, right? There's no mediation, which means that any node can communicate with any other node. And by node, I just mean some unit in the network, like a computer, right? Authorization is based on mutual configuration. So on the internet, I can connect to your computer if you run a service in your computer that gives me permission to connect it, and vice versa, right? So it's the mutual configuration that controls authority and how authority is given. And each participant is autonomous, right? So nobody depends on anybody else in a true mesh network, right? Star networks are a different kind of networks. These are two topologies, or two of the main topologies in computer networks. In star networks, all participants connect with the operator. So this means that the nodes do not connect with each other, but they all connect with a central node. And all interactions between participants is mediated by that central node. So the operator can control what all the participants can do. So it's not based on mutual configuration, like in a mesh network. It's based on the operator's privileges that they assign, right? So authorization is granted by the operator, right? So you have privileges to do certain things on the network or certain things on the application. So privileges granted by the operator, right? And each participant is dependent on the operator for their right to participate at all. They have no other independent means to communicate to anybody else using the network, right? So this is a star network, right? So the mesh network is a network in which all the nodes can intercommunicate, and a star network is one where there's an operator, a central node, that controls the interactions between them, right? Communism is similar to a mesh network, at least the theoretical ideal of communism. All participants produce as equals, right? Producers retain everything they produce. Participants produce for social value, and exchange is based on mutual respect. So this is basically the topology of communism, right? Which in many ways is parallel to what a mesh network is like, and we'll go into that more later, right? In capitalism, participants are divided into classes, right? Property owners appropriate wealth from producers, and participants produce for exchange value. Exchange is based on market price, right? So these are the different ways, different features of both capitalism and communism that sort of define them as a mode of production, in the same way that the different topologies define the difference between a mesh network and a star network. These are the features that define theoretically what capitalism is versus what communism is. And again, we're talking about the theoretical terms, not any actually existing places. Okay? And capitalists love star networks because the capitalist is the operator. So the capitalist is able to mediate between the relationships of all the users, right? Roles and credentials create classes, right? Without the ability to have a central role, you can have different gradients of users, right? On a client-server system uses a star network, you can have super users and non-super users. You can have people that have this privilege and that privilege, and you can have different classes of users. In a peer-to-peer network, you really can't. I mean, you can have different user accounts in your own computer, but between the computers, it's all about mutual configuration, right? And mediation is needed to charge a price because capitalist organizations are financed by investors that want to capture a profit. They have to actually be able to mediate the relationships among the users in order to capture value and charge a price. If you can't mediate the relationship, then there's no place for you to, you know, charge your fee, right? When relationships can go individually among the nodes, then there's no way for the capitalist to, you know, put their hat in the middle there and demand somebody throw some change into it, right? So capitalists hate mesh networks because participants can interact directly. So this allows them to evade any kind of capitalist control. There's no toll gate. Without toll gates, you can't have prices. And without privileges, they can't have control. So they can't control what the users are doing. They can't charge them money. And they can't stop them from doing whatever they want directly. So capitalism really doesn't like mesh networks. They're fundamentally opposed things. Now, the internet is a mesh network. Interesting thing about the internet is that it was not created by capitalists, right? It was developed by universities, NGOs, hobbyists in the military, and it really didn't come out of this idea of profit-oriented investment. It came out of various different things, like the military's desire to create a distributed network that would resist attack, universities like wanting to publish scientific papers online in a way that was easily accessible. It was driven by use value. And not by exchange value, right? The people that built the internet had some problems they needed to solve, like military problems, academic problems, or just coordination problems of NGOs. And the internet is not one thing, but a collection of technologies that eventually kind of came together to solve these problems. Different pieces of the internet were built at different times by different people, right? It was not a product. So somebody didn't just say at one time, let's build the internet, right? It just sort of kind of happened as a result of a lot of disparate kind of things, right? Meanwhile, capital was not ignorant of computer networks. Capital also had their own plan, right? And the information superhighway, which is a phrase popularized by Al Gore, was never meant to refer to the internet, right? Even though it's often taken as such, what capitalism was preparing was a bunch of online services, things like CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy, and even earlier things like Plato, educational systems, right? These were the things that capitalists were investing lots of money in. These companies in their prime were very, very huge. AOL continues to exist, although it reinvented itself as this kind of broken internet provider, but it originally was an online service like CompuServe and Prodigy. And it wasn't the internet. It was a completely controlled client-server system that you can only communicate to other users through the system, right? And this is what capital had in mind. This is what capital was going to sell us as the information superhighway, right? And the internet just kind of came out of nowhere from the point of view of capital. It's like the strange research project that just kind of like left the lab, like the killer bees, and just kind of like spread around the world, right? Right, and until the 90s, major corporations had no real internet strategy. Like if you look at the history of the acronym MSN, like the Microsoft Network, it changes meaning through the 90s like 3 or 4 times to try to figure out what the hell the internet even is before it becomes this kind of ICQ clone or whatever the hell it is now, right? But like they had all kinds of different ideas. It was going to be like a service and a portal, and then like it just changes names. And Microsoft even didn't have a browser yet. I mean, right, of course, they introduced their browser in the mid-90s already, long after Netscape already had their IPO and made an unreasonable billionaire out of Andreessen, right? Right, so the important thing about the online services is that they had the client-server topology, which allowed for mediation, and this is why they were attracting investment. This is why all kinds of investors were giving money to companies like CompuServe and AOL and Prodigy, which I said, these were big, well-financed companies that had lots of money, right? And the internet, it was hosting your peer-to-peer systems. There's email, Usenet, IRC, which depend on a mesh topology, right? So you already had these two completely different kinds of online worlds, where you had, on one hand, this client-server online service, on the other hand, you had this internet, which depends on peer-to-peer systems. None of the classic internet technologies, email, Usenet, IRC, work if individual nodes can't connect with each other. If my mail server can't connect to your mail server, I can't send you mail, right? Same with Usenet. So the Usenet servers connect, interchange, same with IRC. The IRC servers form a mesh and communicate in a distributed fashion, right? Because the internet is a peer-to-peer system, anybody with an account, anybody with a connection to it, could also give that connection on, right? And that's an inherent feature of peer-to-peer systems because, again, it's a peer-to-peer system. Every node is equal. So if you have a connection, you can also pass that connection on. This fact created a boom of internet service providers, right? That happened in the early to mid 90s, right? Where all of a sudden internet service providers were popping up left and right, and every city had like 10,000, right? And the capitalists had no idea what was going on. All of a sudden there was all these internet service providers in every city, and capitalism was like, why aren't people interested in AOL and CompuServe anymore, right? Interesting thing about the kind of business that these ISPs were engaging in is that they had nothing really unique to sell, right? Each of these ISPs was just providing access to the network that they had bought from somebody else. They were just passing on their upstream bandwidth. So they would buy some bandwidth from UUNet or the university or some other, wherever they got their connection from, and they would then, you know, get a bunch of consumer-grade modems and put them on a shelf and sell dial-up accounts to other people, right? So what they were actually selling was just being part of the internet. There wasn't anything that differentiated themselves. It wasn't like CompuServe or AOL or Prodigy, which competed on features like our chat rooms are better, or like we have these great forums, or like you can buy shareware through our shareware store, right? It was just really you get to be part of the internet, and that's it, and run whatever software you want that runs on the internet and connect with everybody you want to connect to that's on the internet, right? So it was the internet itself, right? And so the value of what they were selling wasn't from what they were actually making or providing, it was from the network itself. The reason what they were selling was valuable is because the value of what they were selling came from the size of the networks. Everybody wanted to be part of this growing network. So it was the actual size of the network that they were selling, and by selling more accounts, we're expanding the size of the network, right? And so communism loves a mesh network, because each ISP was independently earning income by being a part of a common platform that wasn't owned by anybody as a whole, right? So none of them owned the internet. They all were the internet. They composed the internet, right? So the internet was composed of the mutual interconnections of the participants. That is where the value was, right? And this doesn't resemble a market economy at all, but rather a network economy, right? Because it's just a question of the composition, right? So the network was what the value was, right? Capitalists weren't happy about this. This was a big shock in the early 90s, and you know, like people were fired, and all kinds of angst was being felt by the big players in the internet, and they had to do something about this. They couldn't deny that the internet had captured the world by storm, and nobody cared about AOL and CompuServe anymore, and those seemed to be like antiquated, outdated things that nobody wanted accounts anymore on them. And so what happened was the dot-com boom. The capitalists simply bought everything. They just, all of a sudden, they raised tons of capital, which is what capitalists are good at, and they simply bought everything in sight. It didn't matter if it was stupid, if it could ever make money, they didn't even try to understand it, they just bought everything that they could find, everything. And that created this huge boom that we all remember as the dot-com boom, where all of a sudden, companies who never really had a clear business plan, and small ISPs were being purchased for huge amounts of money, right? And what happened was consolidation. If you had an internet account in the mid-90s, it was from one of these tiny internet providers that, like, I don't know how many people were online in the 90s here, but if you had an account then, it was probably from just the ISP down your block that was, like, owned by who knows who. Some, you know, they somehow had, like, you know, a Perl hacker and some guy that knew Linux a little bit and a bunch of modems, and that was their ISP, and that's where you got your account from, right? And of course, today is much different. Today we all get online through giant telecommunication conglomerates. So the end result of capital discovering the internet was they simply bought everything. And now we have to work with giant conglomerates to get our accounts. These small ISPs are no longer there. And that wasn't good enough for them, because despite the fact that now they own the internet is still this kind of peer-to-peer communistic thing where people can still exchange directly and, you know, communicate directly in an unmediated fashion, right? And so the next issue was then how do we stop this? How do we get back in control? Now we own it. Now the question is, how can we make it look more like what we originally wanted to sell, right? And this is what Web 2.0 is, and the whole investment boom that went into Web 2.0, right? The web, even though it runs on the internet, is actually a client-server platform. It's not itself a peer-to-peer platform, right? The web is the web. Each web server is like an individual little CompuServe, where the operator of that web server has full control. And when you communicate, you know, over an application that is a web-based application, all your communications are going through that one operator. So when you're using email, your email server is connecting to somebody else's email server. It's a distributed communication. And, you know, if you have your own email server, nobody can take your email account away because it's your email server. And even if you get into a fight with your ISP and they take your email account away, you can go to another ISP and get a different email account, right? If you're talking about a Web 2.0 based communication platform like Facebook or something like that, they have complete control over your communication, your ability to interact with other users. much, again, like the CompuServe, right? So you have all of the traditional internet applications that were based on mesh topologies being replaced by client-server applications that are based on star topologies, right? So Usenet is being replaced by web forums. We had a presentation yesterday about 4chan, which is kind of this big web forum. And all the stuff that's going on 4chan, maybe with slightly different terminology, originally was going on Usenet. We have these like chaotic, uncontrollable, anonymous groups where nobody could censor them and nobody could know who was posting what unless they wanted them to be known. And that was sort of taken for granted in the early internet. Whereas in now, it's not taken for granted anymore. And in fact, 4chan is kind of like the strange anomaly. But it's still a centralized system run by one organization, actually one guy, as far as I know, right? Christopher Poole. And, you know, if he has a change of heart and, you know, gets seduced by capitalists to take billions of dollars to, like, make 4chan 2.0, maybe that whole community is gone. It's literally in the hands of one person, right? They could just change it overnight. Usenet was not like that because Usenet was a distributed system. Nobody owned Usenet. Usenet was composed of all the people who ran Usenet servers. And somebody can take down their server, but that server wouldn't get rid of Usenet. Usenet would still be there, right? So Usenet can't go away. It's still there now. It's just that nobody uses it, nobody invests in it, so the interfaces are all archaic and access is hard to provide. The ISPs don't provide access anymore. You have to get commercial access. But despite all that, Usenet is still there, and it can't, and it will always be there because it doesn't depend on any one organization or person, right? And likewise, email is being replaced by social media, so people are now communicating instead of through their email servers by social media. And as we all know, email now sucks, and it doesn't suck because there's something inherently wrong with email. It sucks because nobody is spending any money or time making it better. So all the interfaces to it, all of the like spam systems, and you know. Authentication systems could easily be in email. It doesn't have to be in Facebook. There could be decentralized approaches to handling these things. You could build a social network around SMTP if you wanted to. But nobody's doing that because who's going to pay for it, right? They want, you know, what the capitalists want to pay for is a centralized platform they can control. So there's plenty of money for Facebook, but not so for email. And IRC, of course, is being replaced by Twitter and other kinds of instant messenger kinds of things that are once again based on a centralization, a control in one organization that mediates between the users. And P2P, which was the core innovation of the internet, that's what made the internet so exciting and was the big news in the 90s of, oh my God, peer-to-peer technology is going to take over the world and change everything. Now it's become a contraband. Now P2P is like actually a negative word. It's a negative term, right? You can, like, you know, if you look at the way P2P is used in conversation in the media, it's a technology that's used by thieves and pirates, right? And like it's completely become a contraband. And not from once the core innovation that actually took the internet from you know obscure laboratories and universities to destroying well-funded organizations like CompuServe, now it's like a negative term, right? And it's actually being engineered out of the internet, right? If you look at the way investments are going, like everything is going towards more control. Like the routers are now getting into like deep packet inspection to make sure that you're not like, you know, tunneling any kind of like contraband traffic over your port 80 and that, you know, you're just going to see Facebook. And even the whole telecoms package, I don't know if anybody followed that. I mean, the whole way that the internet is sold is being questioned. In the daydreams of the telecoms that now sell you internet access, they don't even want to sell you internet access. They want to sell you packages of websites. So when you see you like a basic account that gives you like Facebook and Twitter and Wikipedia, or like an extended account that gives you like you know that plus like BBC or something like that, and that's how they want to sell the internet. They want to sell the internet in the same way that cable TV and mobile telephones are sold, based on services, right? They don't want to give you a wire to a peer-to-peer network that you can send any data you want down the way you have now. They don't want that, right? And so that's being engineered. And it's being engineered out because of venture capitalism, right? And the way venture capitalism functions is because the venture capitalists have privileged access to accumulated wealth. They can capture the wealth of the future because the innovators of today, the people that are inventing innovative new platforms, don't themselves have access to the wealth required to actually implement and promote these platforms. So they require the wealth. They have to sell the future productivity of their platforms before they even can build them, right, in order to get the capital they need to get started. And if they don't do that, then they can't exist, right, because they can't compete against the more well-funded, right? So they become immediately out of the club if they don't take venture capital, right? Right, so the dead, stolen value of the past captures the unborn value of the future. And that's, you know, pretty much a paraphrase of any kind of socialist or communist literature. It's not only about the internet. Capitalism does that in every other field as well. So it's no should be of no surprise that it's doing that also in the internet. The only real surprise is that the internet exists at all because of this because of its strange history. And so if we really want to have a free society modeled after peer networks, free software, gift economies, and the pastoral commons, we need to find a way for innovation to be born free. I mean, even though I'm a computer engineer, I wasn't at first attracted to the internet because of technological reasons. I was attracted to the internet because of my interest in art and politics. Because the internet and its structure, its peer-to-peer structure, represented to me an existential threat to capital. Because capital depends on extraction and mediation, and it depends on national territories to give privilege in the nation state. The way the internet was of like this peer-to-peer network that went across borders seemed to me like the end of capitalism, because without this ability to control borders and control mediation, capitalism could not exist, right? And that was, of course, in the 90s, a very sort of naive viewpoint, right? But this was the middle of like the anti-globalization movement, and you know, things really seemed good at the time. It seemed like everything was exploding, but it was all retrenched back. But we've talked then, and we've talked since about how the how the internet can be an inspiration for a new kind of society, right? That kind of conversation has been going on since then. It's become a little bit less utopian and less naive now than it was then, but it's still present. People still talk about how social relationships are being transformed by online communications and by the internet. And there's a lot of hope placed, like I said, in a society that involves aspects of free software, gift economies, peer networks, and you can read dozens of like blog posts and articles about this any given day. But the problem is that in order for that to actually happen, the innovation that it takes to make it happen has to be born free. It can't already be pre-sold to capitalists before it even has a chance to exist. And that's what's happening right now. So all of the brightest people developing like online communication technologies, the only way they can make their communication technology actually work and actually exist is by selling its future productivity now to the capitalists, and then explaining how they're going to engineer control into it so the capitalists can make their investment back. And if they can't explain that, then it won't get invested in, and then it can't exist, except for like on the margins in universities and art projects and things like that. Right? Capitalism will not fund P2P. And exactly because it requires enclosure and privileged access to scarce resources so it can capture profit. Sorry, I said that too fast. Because it requires enclosure in order to capture profit. It has to have some kind of a scarce resource that it controls access to. Without the creation of scarcity, you can't have exchange value. Like the exchange value in a market system comes from reproduction costs. Things that don't have any reproduction costs can also not have any exchange value. You can't sell what can be reproduced infinitely, right? So in order for something to be sold, it has to have scarcity. There has to be some reason why it can't be replicated, or that there's a cost associated with replicating it. And so therefore, capitalism won't fund anything that doesn't have that feature, right? That doesn't have like the network rules kind of feature, in the words of Halverian. And so P2P will not be funded, right? Yes, capitalism requires a star topology and requires enclosure, privileged access to scarce. I think we said this already. You get the point. Capitalism, P2P, won't fund it. No money. No money for P2P. So this is why I talk about this idea of venture communism. And venture communism is not something that I propose as some kind of system that we've pre-rolled and predefined. You know, venture communism is a concept, and it's a concept that Teleco Ministin has worked some ways to help explore, but it's not, as I said, it's not like a plug-and-play formula that you can like chart on a wall. There's no UML diagram for venture communism. But the basic idea is that we have to find ways in order to create these new things. And we have to find alternative to capitalist financing. Otherwise, we can't create the kinds of things that we think need to be created in order to create the kind of society that we think is possible if these things could be created and sustained. Right? So in order to create a society where we produce and share on equals, we need something like venture communism, which, as I said, is something that we need, is not something that we have. So I can't exactly tell you how venture communism will work, although we can, if you have specific questions, we can discuss some aspects of it, right? I don't know why this is repeating everything. I think that might be it. I think we're done. That's it. That's the last slide. So that was pretty fast, And I hope some of that was actually understandable. And if it wasn't, I'm very happy to have a discussion with everybody, because I think that we can clarify some things with a bit of interaction.
Yeah, actually, that's perfect. So any questions from the audience to clarify aspects of Dimitri's talk? Or Okay.
What's your position on like P2P, microcredits, Kickstarter?
I think those things are great.
Is that the direction you're thinking, or?
I think that's part of it. I would like to
see them have a more ideological angle. Like, you can use Kickstarter to start a capitalist organization, so that doesn't actually help anything, right? If you use Kickstarter to start a company that exploits wages, then this doesn't actually drive us forward. So, you know, well, I think we need something, things like Kickstarter, but I think that they should be more political in what they will fund, right? They have to say, yes, we will, you know, we'll provide funding for this organization, but only if it is a cooperative organization that doesn't then contribute to the problem later on.
First of all, thank you very much for your talk. It's just my point. I see the problem not in any technology, but in the brain of the people. As I have observed in the last years, there are the slaves who have a more and more strong desire for star networks. Mm-hmm. And this is incredible, but it is like this. On the contrary, even the wealthier managers or so have a sense for peer networks, but the lower, also the artists and scientists are, the more they have a strong attitude to the great, great star networks, capitalist networks. It's like, Führer, where are you?
Well, I think it's really. Well, most people are interested in, so the applications is specifically in the kinds of relationships these applications enable. And most people are actually uninterested in the topology of the underlying application. And really, in sort of an ideal world, why should they be? I mean, what they want to do is communicate and share, right? And that's what these things should enable. And so I think it's natural for people to think that star networks are the normal thing when they are the normal thing, right? It's not surprising. But I don't think that people would mind if they were peer networks. I think that what they're interested in is how to share. And yeah, I mean, certainly there's still business people that are talking about peer networks, but they're like proprietary peer networks like Skype that are peer networks on the back end, meaning that they take advantage of the peer network architecture in order to lower their own costs, like the way Skype uses your computer and to like pass through phone calls and things like that. But they don't give you access to the peer network, right? It's a proprietary peer network.
So there's this interesting term that came up in the mid-1990s, the Californian ideology. Mm-hmm. Can you refer to that? Or is this like a specific like analysis from the mid-90s that cannot be applied to what's happening now?
The California ideology is unfortunately still quite dominant in the
maybe
in
you
the
could
whole.
Give it yeah please explain
okay,
it yeah
the California nice. Ideology it was an essay written by Professor Richard Barbrook in the 90s, and what he was criticizing was the emergence of the ideology surrounding the free software community and just the internet community in general, especially guys like Eric Raymond, who are like libertarian gun nuts, and people that really had this kind of like individualistic, like hyper right-wing libertarian interpretation of where society was going, and so that's what the California ideology kind of represents. That this kind of network libertarianism, and Richard Barbrook criticizes that in his essay. And I think this kind of attitude that we can kind of do what we want if we're just smart enough and good enough, it's still actually really unfortunately very strong in the hacker community. It's actually I would say it's just as dominant now as it was then. I think there's been a disconnect between the hacker community and the activist community as a result. Whereas in the early 90s, the kind of like the hacker and activists were kind of much closer together. The activists have become a lot less utopian and naive. But of course, they've been replaced by liberals like Kickstarter. So I guess there's different kinds of problems. But I think it's totally still completely valid, completely relevant.
Thank you for this very spirited talk. It was very fast, but nonetheless, I think you provide us with a lot of good arguments to defend mesh networks. So thank you for that. Actually, at that moment when your slides ended, this is when I thought, now we're going to get the example. So how do we get started? I mean, because the question obviously here is, even if the idea is very strong, but how you still have people who are entangled in star networks for reasons of their livelihood, because they want to eat and live somewhere. So, and also, if we look at the way that web startups now work, either you keep it as your private hobby, or you succumb to the paths of evil, that is, you try to get venture capital and then end up hiring people for their exchange value. So, congratulations, you've been co-opted by the system. Do you have some ideas, or what are your fantasies, utopias, strategies for breaking out of that cycle?
Well, the situation you've described, I completely agree with. That is the situation we're in. I think that it's unrealistic to say that, you know, startups can just not accept venture capital without an alternative model, because you're right. Either it's some kind of a hobby, which means that it's obscure and it'll never get anywhere, and if it does get anywhere, then it'll be immediately co-opted, imitated, and stolen by venture capital the minute it has any relevance at all, right? But a strange exception of things like 4chan that the capitalists simply don't want because it's just too dirty for them, right? So they're just not interested. But anything else that's even remotely interesting would just be, if they can't buy it directly, they'll just clone it and make their own. So it's, you know, and the reason that I end the presentation there, and I've done the same thing with previous presentations, is exactly that I don't want to stand here and say this is exactly the formula that we have to follow, right? It's not a program that I'm offering, right? It's a criticism. I do have ideas, and the Telecomunist didn't explore those ideas, and I write about them, but I don't have what amounts to be a here's the program of how we can get out of this, right? But I think that, the gentleman over here mentioned Kickstarter. So I think that some kind of a bond-like system, like some kind of bond market, a bond-based peer microfinancing system could be used as a form to raise capital, so selling bonds and not shares. Because the difference between bonds and shares is significant to me, because when a company sells a bond, it doesn't sell any ownership of the company. It doesn't sell equity. It's only a promise to pay back. So, like, you know, Benjamin Tucker once said that the natural return to capital is the capital returned. And that's it, right? So that the only fair return to capital is to give the capital back. Right, and any more than that is then not fair, right? And so I think bonds enable that kind of a relationship in a way that shares don't, right? As I mentioned before, I also think that the financing should come with strings attached, that it shouldn't come with, like, you know, just because you're independent today that you're a good guy, because, like I said, today's independent is tomorrow's wage exploiter, right? So I think that we need to create ways of funding that guarantees that the organizations that are started will continue to grow and develop within the context of peer production and, like, a commons-based form of production, not just simply, you know, take advantage of peer financing because they have no other alternative and then go on to exploit wages, which is a very common failure pattern in the cooperative movement itself. So many times cooperatives are formed by people who form them out of necessity, not out of any ideology, but because they don't have any other choice. The only way they can sort of start their agrarian community or whatever is through a cooperative, but then as soon as they're successful, they start exploiting wage labor. So the original cooperative members become kind of like this elite class that is cooperative, and then they have a new level of slaves that work for them. And this is a very common failure, or the demutualization, like what happened to the
building societies in England, where they were simply invaded by sock puppets for capital, who then voted to demutualize them, right? So in a capitalist society, it's very difficult to create an anti-capitalist structure, because the entire legal system of capitalism is meant to guarantee capital and privacy. So you can't just somehow, you know, make an organization and defend it in perpetuity, right? So that's why, to me, it's important that the ideology is very prominent in it, unlike you know what it is in the Kickstarter or Prosper or something like that, where it's like, yeah, there's very interesting, even revolutionary things going on there, but it's not presented as such. And because it's not presented as such, it's presented only as a convenience. And if it's only a convenience, then today's convenience can be abandoned tomorrow. And then all of a sudden, there's different opportunities that open up tomorrow. And so, and then we have the same system as before, just with a different slavers, I suppose, right? So, but I think, to get back to your question, I think that a bond-like mechanism could at least provide a way to allocate funds. And then, when I talk about the networked economy or network communism, there's a difference between what I'm talking about when I talk about venture communism and normal cooperative production. Because, I mean, like, capitalist production is characterized by, propertyless workers applying their labor to the property owned by a property class of non-workers, right? That's the normal kind of structure of capitalism. Cooperative production is based on workers collectively employing their collectively owned means of production, right? But since that's still an individual collective of workers, there's still plenty of room for exploitation among workers, because the collectives themselves, the cooperatives themselves, have unequal access to scarce resources and skills and things like that. So there's still plenty of opportunity for one cooperative, because of its superior access to property, to exploit a different cooperative by having unfair exchange with that cooperative, right? So when I talk about venture communism, the way I see it working is more like the way free software is, or the way peer production is described. A network of cooperatives that collectively own all of the assets, so that each of the cooperatives doesn't even own their own property themselves, but the entire network of cooperatives owns everybody's property together, right? And so the major issue here is allocation. Right? It's like, well, if we have like this network of cooperatives and they all own their property together, well, that's fine for software and information, because you can just make as many copies as you need, but it's not so good for like power tools or drills or, you know, any, right, where they can only be in one place at a time, right? You only have a limited amount of them. So allocation is the problem, and this is why peer production has emerged in the software realm first. It's not that it's only plausible there. It's because the allocation issue is much easier to answer when you're talking about allocating immaterial resources. So one interesting solution, a potential solution, which is actually really old, it goes back to like Turgot or like Henry George in the States, is this idea of rent sharing, which is it sounds counterintuitive at first, but the network could quite simply rent the property to the collectives that want to employ them, right? But then take the money that they receive for that rent and just simply give it equally back to all members of the collective. And this produces an interesting effect, because if any individual or collective uses their exact per capita share of the mutual property of the network, what they receive in rent and what they pay in rent is actually balanced, and they pay nothing at all. But if they need a greater percentage, per capita percentage of the property of the network, then they have to pay more than they collect. So there has to be a productive reason they would do that, or they would simply give the property back. There's no motivation for them to hoard extra property, because if they're not putting it to productive use, they're going to say, well, you know, I don't want to pay more rent because I'm not receiving that much back, so I'm going to return this property, and it can be allocated to somebody who wants it. And conversely, when people are like not in a productive state of their lives or whatever, they're consuming less property of the network than their per capita share. So actually their dividend from the rent would actually be greater. And so it would actually serve as some kind of a, you know, something like a basic income, but in a much more economically viable way than what's produced by the liberal basic income model. Does that answer your question a little bit? And again, these are all sketches. I don't have like a proper, like this is the program kind of answer.
I have two small questions. One is, how do you have this kind of very kind of two-sided dichotomy, right? Mm-hmm. How do things like these increasingly large foundations fit in? Say, Wikimedia as a foundation or mm-hmm. Apache foundations that are on the one hand supporting peer production in a way, and on the other hand, particularly kind of the software ones are all industry controlled.
Well, the funny thing about capitalism is that within capitalism, only capital can be free. And all these organizations actually produce capital. Software is a form of capital. It's a general input to production. So all kinds of organizations use this software in production, and they don't capture the value by controlling the software. They capture the value by deriving things upstream and selling that. So like, companies that work online, they need a web server. They don't need to sell the web server. They need to have the web server. So in capitalism, the only thing that can be free is capital, because the capitalists need it as a general input to production. So Wikipedia, Apache has a function for capitalists. So it's not a threat to them. But things that actually deliver value, if they actually deliver value to the end user, the Apache web server delivers no value to users of the internet directly. If nobody builds an application with it and implements it to serve websites, the existence of the Apache web server does not actually satisfy any use value, right? But if it satisfies use value, if it's not capital, if it's actually consumer good, it's actually an end good, then it can't be free and they won't fund it unless they can control it, right? So I think all of these foundations have their roles and reasons, and you can't create a general rule because, of course, history doesn't work that way and there's always exceptions and outliers. But in the general sense, anything creates end value, the capitalists want to control and capture profit on. Anything that just creates use value in production, again, in production, not use value to end users, is no problem. Like, I mean, there's been examples from all of history of like standardization bureaus. I mean, like, you know, like capital has a whole apparatus of various foundations and standardization institutions that provide things that help capitalists make things they eventually sell. Right, so this is actually, to me, fits more into that. So I see no difference between the Apache Foundation and the organization that tests electronics to make sure they don't interfere with airplanes or whatever. Right, it's just something the capital needs, and they'll fund it. And sometimes it makes more sense for them to fund it jointly.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just sort of curious if you've looked a lot at the background of the the struggles between farmers and the railroad in the late 1800s.
Sure, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because that's like basically what the whole thing the railroads did was they gave rebates to big shippers so they didn't have rail neutrality. And farmers tried to form co-ops to try and fight against that, but I mean, ultimately, it didn't quite work.
No, they also gave away huge land to rich railway barons. Kevin Carson, an American anarchist mutualist writer, talks about the railways and how the building of the railways in America was very core to the development of class stratification and development of the elite in America, and that the railway system and its build out was basically kind of like a form of America's enclosure, where like a lot of the farmers were displaced from their land. Of course, the valuable land was given to very rich, privileged people. The rights of way for the tracks themselves, and the right. So it was all. It was really very much part of the capitalization, class stratification of America.
I guess you're familiar with the term of cognitive capitalism.
Sure.
Sure.
How
does that fit into the whole thing? And just to give a brief example, cognitive capitalism pretty much, as a summary, would say we are all unpaid workers. Mm-hmm. We all write our Facebook updates. We all write on Twitter. And by doing that, we kind of help... The value of Facebook rises, the value of Twitter rises. So we are like workers, but we are not paid for what we're doing.
Yeah, well, that's what my essay Info Enclosure was about. And like now it's actually quite a common criticism, the whole idea of crowdsourcing. And like, I mean, if you think about like YouTube, like I use this example, it's a little bit antiquated now, but I think it still illustrates the point really well. I mean, YouTube sold for something like $2 billion, right? That was like the $2 billion that Google paid for YouTube. Now, YouTube is a website that you can probably get like a team of five programmers to build in a weekend, like which is evidenced by the millions of clones of YouTube, like Dailymotion and stuff like that, right? So where's the value? Why is YouTube worth $2 billion when it's a relatively simple video board?
Billion.
$2 billion, right. When it's a relatively simple video board, right? The reason is because of its user base, right? So the value of YouTube has nothing at all to do with what YouTube is. It has to do with the value of all the videos and interactions that the users contribute to YouTube, right? And so this forms the basis of the value, and this is what Google paid for. But of course, how much of that $2 billion did the users get for creating this value? Well, of course, they didn't get anything because they don't own it. It's the YouTube people owned it, right? And I think this is kind of an example of how the process works. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it's just like throwing it in, and
yeah, right.
Some people just like don't. It's always a good term to know.
Or rather, consumer communism.
Well,
because in the digital age, this is more and more the business model that all the companies trying to adopt. I mean, I mentioned the other day we are commodities of Google, for
right.
example,
mm-hmm.
And such like yeah. thing everywhere, and became a successful yeah. business model for a lot of all these company and venture capitalists to go in, so that you'll be all my employees unpaid. Thanks for raising the point.
Well, it's not really so new. There's a Canadian economist and media theorist called Dallas Smythe that wrote in the 50s about what he called the consciousness industry and the audience commodity. Dallas Smythe created a model of a commodity model for media, which didn't really exist at the time, and he considered the neglect of media by economists to be the blind spot, right? And so he created a model that I think makes a lot of sense even today, where the value of the media is not the media itself. The value of the media is the value of its audience, right? So actually, what a media company is selling is not videos or music. What a media company is selling is the audience of those videos or music, and they're selling it to who? They're selling it to people that want to control their behavior through one way or another, right? To what he described as the consciousness industry, which is the advertisers, lobby groups, people that want you to vote this way or think this way or buy this or that, right? So the economic model of media, as like I said, it was already in the 50s described by Adam Smith, long before YouTube was over $2 billion, right? But this has been understood for a long time that actually it's the audience. It's the audience that's being sold, not the program or the video or the music or whatever.
Okay, I would say let's open up the discussion. Like a big applause for Mr. Kleiner. And let's have something like a 10-15 minutes closing round, let's would call it. So it's the end of the Powerflow Symposium 2010, and maybe some additional comments. They don't necessarily have to focus on your talk, just any kind of statements, stuff that you found interesting, or maybe stuff that we should all look into in the future. I don't know. I'm just like want to pass the microphone on to gather a couple of statements about the last 3 days, I guess. If you give them the freedom, they don't take it. You're supposed to say, no, fuck you, I'm not working for you, I go home now. No, no. The basic idea would be just like maybe something like a closing round. So maybe a couple of like statements about what was specifically interesting for you in the last 3 days. I don't know. That's not any one of you. So anyone. So it's... Because we always try to find different people from many different backgrounds, philosophy, technology, etc., etc., etc. And it was interesting for us later on to find out. That was like an interesting talk, because I would never have thought about that in that way before. Something like trying to find out. I would say that in like if you like. companies, like if you fill out like you have like this 5-point system of like 1 star or 5 stars. So that talk was a 5-star, but that was only like a 1-star because I already knew that. I don't know. Yeah.
Dmitry, I'm still trying to process everything you said because you talk so damn quick. But tell me, did I get it right that venture communism takes up the same structural methods as venture capitalism? So, and just the goals are different?
Just return that one. It's okay.
Hello.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I think is a very dangerous kind of way to think about politics is this idea that I call kind of whiteboardism. Like we can have a whiteboard and we can kind of like create like this diagram of this perfect society and then go, hey, yeah, let's just do that, right? Because it doesn't work that way. It's not a battle of ideas. It's a struggle. It's a battle of capacities, right? So in order for us to say that society should be like this or that, we first have to answer how are we going to impose this new society over top of the people that are trying to impose the present society, right? So it has to be thought of in terms of struggle, right? You know, the new society has to defeat the old society. It's not just a question of suggesting it, right? And so in that sense, venture communism is exactly considered to be like the mirror image of venture capital, the enemy of venture capital. So we exist in this system, and we can't just rewrite all of its rules. We still have to start in the system that we're in. And in order to do that, like I said, I totally see a venture commune as being exactly like the same kind of joint stock corporation that a venture capital fund is. And again, this seems counterintuitive in a sense, but anything else would be delusional, right? Because what we need an alternative to venture capital, and if we have to make it in this society, not in an imaginary society, which means it actually has to serve the same legal and economic function as the venture capital organization that it's replacing.
Or actually two follow-up questions. So how do I differentiate between like a good, genuine venture communist piece in front of me, or if it's just like a fake venture communist piece that is done by a capitalist trying to convince me it's a venture communist piece, like it happens a lot nowadays, like BP saying, oh, there are all these environmental health stuff making now?
Yeah, Rebel Cell is a book that came out that talks about that. I don't know. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I can tell you what the conceptual litmus test would be. It would definitely be the ownership structure and whether the people that produce end up owning what they produce. I mean, that's the simple litmus test, right? If the product is owned by the people that produce it, then you don't have capitalism, right? But how you can know that, I don't know. I think since we're talking about the information age, I think there could be, you know, ways to share this information through mutual recommendation. And I think the internet itself, if we are able to save it from demolition, you know, offers answers to this. Like there could be boards where you can say, hey, that's a fake cooperative, if that were to be a problem.
And nobody minds if I just add my second question. So this defeating of the old system, would you agree with Maxwell Salzberg from Diaspora, whom I interviewed on the Ars Electronica, and I was quite surprised to see. I didn't know so much about Diaspora, mm-hmm. and I thought like, yeah, they want to beat Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
But actually, it was pretty much just about like being better than Mark Zuckerberg and defeating it by making it obsolete. That's
yeah.
what he said.
Yeah.
And I was teasing him by saying, oh, you're just, so what makes you different from being a new Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah.
So making obsolete, would that be your strategy as well? Would you agree?
Well, essentially, you could say it that way, but I mean, if I want to talk about Diaspora particularly, I think that's actually a pretty good example because Diaspora is one of the biggest successes in Kickstarter, right? And, they raised like what, almost 200,000 or over 200,000 US dollars, for a peer finance project is huge. It's really huge, right? Now, if you think about who they've chosen as their enemy, Facebook, right? And you think about $200,000, you're talking about two or three man years in the IT industry. That's what you're talking about. How many man years did it take to build Facebook? We're talking about hundreds, right? So if he wants to beat Facebook with $200,000, I don't even know if that strategy is wrong or right morally. It's just incredibly naive that's going to happen, right? That he's going to make a better Facebook with $200,000.
it simply can't be done, because anything that he can, you know. But remember, distribution doesn't add use value. I agree that it's very important politically, but I can't see millions of users migrating from Facebook to Diaspora simply because it's distributed. Most of them won't even understand what that means, right? Because Facebook is in their browser, right? Right. So, like I said, I think people are looking for features. They're not looking for topologies, right? I mean, a few of us are, certainly. Those of us that are active in the area certainly are. But we represent a very tiny fringe of the people that care. Everybody else is looking for their mom and their cousin and their sister. And, they don't really understand or have much interest in how the wiring works underneath all that, right? So, and again, this illustrates the problem. So, you have on one hand that Diaspora is funded by Kickstarter, and they're right now, all good, making all good noises. They want to be distributed and open source, but who knows really? When the offer from, Kleiner, or one of the VC firms comes to say, hey, we like what you guys are doing. How about we give you $10 billion and we make this all proprietary, right? Who knows how that's going to be? I don't see a sustainable way of how Diaspora can really defeat Facebook. On the other hand, is like. What do they mean? What do they mean by better, right?
I didn't mean it so much in a sense of if it's technologically possible, but rather in a sense of you try to be more sexy than Facebook. Yeah. So I think there's also venture communism sounds very much to me like cyber feminism. So you try to be more sexy than those technological equipped men. So you just make them obsolete because of course women.
Well, as I said, I'm trying to create, what venture communism needs to do is create a way for innovation to be created without being pre-sold before it's even created. That's the main problem that we need to fix.
I'm curious then if you could do something like take something off of arts colonies where it's just you want some experience doing this, all right, come out to this this ranch and work on software for 6 months.
Absolutely, I think that capitalism is notoriously bad at employing labor. Structural unemployment is a feature of the capitalist system, and it's creating unemployment is the main method of what they call inflation targeting, of keeping currency value stable. So there's a lot of surplus labor lying around if you can mobilize it. And I certainly think the mobilization of surplus labor is definitely, surplus labor as in extra people, not surplus labor as in the portion of, never mind.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I once studied, in the 1934 governor's election of California, yeah. Upton Sinclair, running sort of basically as a socialist, won the Democratic nomination,
right.
And then they mobilized they created modern politics to
right.
stop him from getting elected.
Right.
They started making trailers and stuff to run in theaters about how bad he was and he was going to ruin California because he had this whole plan of putting unemployed workers on unproductive land and trying to slowly crowd out capitalism. It was crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. They don't want you to do that. Well, there's a famous cliche, right? Everybody knows it, right? It's like if voting could change anything, they'd make it illegal, right? And I think you can see that in any kind of sense when there is some kind of radical movement within the political system that it gets de-radicalized and diffused and even made illegal, if possible, very, very quickly, right? So. But we weren't supposed to go back to communism, where we were supposed to talk about paraflows broadly.
Whatever you want to talk about.
I guess maybe I'll start the roundup. Okay. There is a specter haunting paraflows, the specter of Google. It's collecting information on us and our streets and not the developed world. And eventually, when there's a universe-spanning supercomputer, it's going to bring everyone back who has contributed to its system and put videos of themselves on YouTube and added value to their systems, and everyone else will not be resurrected. So that's our problem.
Definitely is. That's a nice summary. That's. I mean, Christian Heller mentioned that he was surprising. No, not, I can remember what you said, but the good thing about you is, and that's I guess you referring to, is because you tweet all the stuff you're doing, and there are like five or six things you mentioned during the whole conference, and one thing was the creepiness of Jane Tingley's plant installations, I remember. I want to know why they are really creepy. Why are they creepy?
There's all this stuff that suddenly gets treated as, for example, the disembodied mouths that you showed, or actually plants suddenly emitting, if I understood it correctly, breathing sounds. This all very much is to me what I would expect in a very, to me, joyful way from some body horror movie, and it sort of disintegrates the distinction between what is me as a human body and identity to this whole other area of stuff, and puts disintegrates stuff and puts it back together in a way that is wrong, in a very stimulating way. Yeah, that's basically what I experienced when I saw that.
I have a good idea of a game now. So you played the ping pong to Jane, and I give you the microphone, and you make a statement and give the ping pong to another speaker.
Yeah. No, I don't want to do that.
You play the game or you lose?
I lose them.
Ah. Okay, so ball dropped. Okay, I have to play another ball to someone here. That's hard. Then there's no one left. I wanted to play a ball to the Günther. Is he? There's not the Rune. Okay, doesn't work. Okay, another try. Another try. What I found interesting is that although there is a constant political like Paraflos is a political conference, but it took a very long time until your talk that there is actually like factual political like activism, factual political talk was going on, although all the talks are political in a certain way. Maybe a question to the audience, maybe someone can answer that. What was your a worthwhile political insight that you gained during Paraflos? Not specifically about Dimitri, because we have talked about him and his talks a long time, but something that's an interesting spark of political discourse that you will take with you in the future. I don't know.
I mean, I abhor a vacuum, so I step in. But I guess I had the thought when I was preparing the talk on long-distance relationships that if there are any like green Marxists out there, they're going to jump all over me because I'm aiding and abetting the creation of these long-distance relationships that are going to just cause more people to get together with other people from very far away, and they're going to get into planes and burn all kinds of carbon and release emissions. And if I make it easier for people, then I am simply a reformist who's abetting the system. So that was my fear.
Okay. My counter is that as early as like the early 1960s, Arthur C. Clarke said that the very moment that there will be no long distance calls anymore, that will be the moment of world revolution. Of course, we have that moment. We have Skype and stuff like that. But where is the fucking world revolution? It did not happen. It's just like, well, yeah,
I mean, the issue is like how do you form a relationship with some guy on the other side of the planet? Like, you know, I guess you could just call up random Skype numbers and ask them if they want to start the revolution, but that seems like a very long process.
It's like the leftist version of chat roulette. Yeah, like you don't see penises, you people shout at you, we should start the revolution. I mean, I kind of like that. It's okay. Yeah.
You build that. It's a great idea. You just like you just call a number, it connects you to some random person, and you start to plan the revolution. And that's it. It's very simple.
Yeah, that might be one of the major problems. Actually, there are so many things doable.
They wouldn't be wearing pants, and that's where the whole thing would fall apart.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The whole story of like, even if people scream for revolution, only the people would only see it if they're penises or breasts or something. So yeah.